Congress doesn't like to legislate these days, so.
Exactly, but you know what? I think the court needs to make them do it, you know?
Right, you're right. If they did strike down Obamacare in full, that would force, because of the unconstitutional provision, that would force Congress to actually do its job and make healthcare policy. Otherwise, they'll drag their heels and not pass anything.
That's right.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. I have a great guest with me here this week, Elizabeth Slattery, who's a senior legal fellow at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I want to encourage everybody to check out Elizabeth's podcast that she hosts through the PLF, the DIST podcast, which breaks down the most famous dissents in Supreme Court history. So the losers, if it would be, from the history of the highest court in this country. So the link to that is in the description, and we're going to talk about some of the related material today, so you'll get a preview. But Elizabeth, I wanted to talk about the idea of the separation of powers, because when we think of the Supreme Court, at least us non-lawyer political people, we often think about it playing as a referee for what politicians can do. This is within your power. This is not. You can't do this. You can do that. But it also stops them from taking each other's power, right?
That's right. You know, I think the structural protections of our Constitution are the greatest limit on government power, and they are essential to securing individual liberty. Justice Scalia, the late Justice Scalia, had this great phrase that he often used, which was that every tin horn dictator in the world today has a Bill of Rights, but it isn't the Bill of Rights that produces freedom. It's the structure of government that our founders came up with, the genius of our Constitution, that prevents anybody from seizing all the power.
So what are some examples of the areas in which the three branches, which obviously judicial, legislative, and executive, kind of often infringe on each other, that the court has had to get involved in policing?
So too often, one of the problems, first and foremost, is that the court doesn't police the limits of the separation of powers. I think there is currently a good majority on the court that is interested in separation of powers issues, but for too long, the court was not willing to engage in that analysis. So I think one of the first problems is that Congress delegates too much of its power to either executive branch departments or agencies, whether they are whether they are independent or quasi-independent. And so that's the first part of the problem. And the court has abdicated any use of what's called the non-delegation doctrine since the 1930s. They basically say, if Congress comes up with what's called an intelligible principle to guide an agency, then that's enough. And Congress can write very broad statutes with broad delegations of power, and then let the agencies fill in these huge gaps with regulatory authority.
So I know why I care about that, but let me ask you, for the average listener, right? Why does it matter to them if it's Congress or bureaucrats in the federal government doing the same thing or working on the same law and enacting it? Well, what's the difference? Is it just about accountability?
Accountability is the most important part. And the framers of the Constitution went to great lengths to make it hard to make laws. So they divided the legislative task between two houses of Congress. They got the president involved by requiring, you know, signing of bills, and gave each of them different constituencies, different lengths in office, and, you know, different modes of election. So I think accountability is the most important thing. And too often, because of the size of the regulatory state, the administrative state, it's impossible for the president and his designees to manage everything that the regulatory state is doing.
And oftentimes, to use a word that's been politicized, right, but the idea of a deep state, is so it struck me as something that obviously, you know, Trump and Republicans put a specific connotation on it. But if you take that connotation away and you just think of the concept of unelected bureaucrats holding enormous sway and are not accountable to voters shaping policy, that is the case in Washington, D.C., right? Like, it seems to me oftentimes that executive agencies will come out with a new rule or a new regulation. You'll be like, wait, I thought they were supposed to enforce rules, not make them.
Right. And I think it lets lawmakers claim credit for doing something. But then they shirk the actual accountability for the results. They can point to those nameless, faceless bureaucrats in Washington who came up with this rule that you don't like, and sort of shift the buck.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because I hadn't thought of this. Why is it? Is it just for that reason, or why is Congress willing to give away its power? Because the framers thought, and this has proved mostly true, right? They thought that men would jealously guard their power and try to stop other people from infringing on it. But in the case of Congress, they've tried to give away as much of their power as possible to the president, to the regulatory state. Is it just because they're so worried about re-election?
Yeah, it's a head scratcher. I think that is a big part of it. But you know, it all kind of has roots to the progressive era in our country when we started to see the rise of these regulatory agencies. And one of the original arguments for them was that these are neutral, independent experts who are going to figure out how to order our lives for us. And we're going to put them in charge of everything. And they won't be political. They won't politicize things. But as we know, that didn't work out the way that people in that era thought it would.
Can you give a few examples of how overreach in terms of going beyond the separation of powers has like affected actual people's lives, to put it in context for people?
Yeah, you know, Pacific Legal Foundation, where I work, has litigated a lot of cases. Many of them involve the EPA. They're one of the big offenders because, you know, they have these broad delegations of authority in things like the Clean Air Act and other statutes that require them to, for example, the Clean Air Act says that the EPA has to issue ambient air standards, but it says that are requisite to protect the public health, which is very broad language. It doesn't set any real standards for the EPA to follow. And as we've seen with our litigation over the course of almost 50 years of PLF, agencies too often are kind of get this tunnel vision, and they, you know, we have some cases, for example, the Sacketts are one of our most famous cases, and they won a unanimous case at the Supreme Court several years ago. I think it was less than 10 years ago. I should know the year, but it's escaping me. Okay. But the Mike and Chantel Sackett wanted to build their dream home in a partially developed subdivision, and the EPA comes flying in and says, "We think this is federally protected wetland." The EPA dragged its feet, wouldn't give any evidence for why they said it was federally protected wetland, and they tried to deny the Sacketts their day in court. They tried to keep them before the agency, before agency adjudicators, and it took a case going all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the justices unanimously said, no, they can challenge this in court, and they can challenge this assertion of authority in court. Well, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, absolutely. So that brings me to an interesting question, which is, in terms of legal philosophy, what is the conservative versus liberal breakdown on this in terms of where a judge nominated by a Republican would tend to view the issue versus a judge nominated by a Democrat?
So it's sort of interesting because when you talk about administrative agencies and you talk about things like courts deferring to agencies, if you look back to when a lot of these doctrines were developed at the Supreme Court, they came from conservatives who were concerned about judges overreaching and putting their policy views into the law rather than just calling balls and strikes. You know, Justice Scalia wrote one of the big agency deference cases from the 1990s. Now, it seems towards the end of his life, he may have started to change his view of whether the deference doctrines actually stopped activist judges or whether they emboldened agency bureaucrats. But today, we do often see sort of a classic breakdown of the more conservative justices are not in favor of giving undue deference to agency officials, whereas the liberals seem to want to give them all the discretion that they can.
So that's an interesting one, right? Because to some extent, you would think that progressive judges would care about the idea of democracy, right? Because the unelected bureaucrats wielding the power, essentially, they're not accountable to voters. That's the problem, right? If you don't like something that Congress does, you can vote against your congressman or congresswoman. You can go campaign against them. You can run ads. But you can't really do anything about the fact that some mid-level associate at a federal agency issued a memo that declared some regulation applying to your property or your business, and now you're out of luck. So do you see, well, I guess just looking forward, right, to the upcoming years of the Supreme Court in this upcoming term, is this something that we might see real change on soon?
Well, I think your listeners probably know that any sort of change in Washington, especially at the Supreme Court, can sometimes take decades, to happen. And the court really likes to take, especially under the leadership of Chief Justice John Roberts, likes to take baby steps towards any sort of change. But in recent years, they've taken a real interest in things like the Appointments Clause and ensuring that people who exercise significant government power are appointed according to the Constitution. So they're not treated like lower level federal employees, but they're appointed either by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. And then ones who are known as inferior officers, Congress can vest their appointment directly in the heads of their departments or agencies. There are a couple other ways they can be appointed as well. But there have been just an explosion of these Appointments Clause cases in recent years. Just this term, there are 3 cases implicating the Appointments Clause, which is not that common. The court only takes about 60 to 70 cases a term. So for one area of the law to have 3 separate cases is a pretty big deal and an indication of where the court may be going in the long term.
Can you give us a big picture sense of what those cases involve and what the outcomes could be?
So big picture, the first one is Collins versus Mnuchin, and it has to do with whether Congress can insulate agency heads from presidential control, whether Congress can say, we're going to give you a tenure protection from being fired by the president. And the court has previously said that's not okay with certain agencies. And so that has now come to the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which was created in response to the mortgage meltdown in around 2008. So that's the first one. The second one is Arthrex versus United States. And this deals with the US Patent and Trademark Office, and they use what are called administrative patent judges. And so the issue is whether they are inferior officers or whether they are principal officers. So do they have to all be appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate, or can they be appointed? Can Congress say, we're gonna let the agency heads appoint them? And the lower court said, well, we think that they're principal officers, but they have tenure protection. So we're just going to strike that part of the statute. And that makes them inferior because now they can be fired without cause. A little bit of a head scratcher.
And so the composition of the court right now is interesting because nominally it has 6 conservatives, right? But you can't really predict Justice Roberts. So what do you think, if you had to bet, I know you can never really know, but where do you think these cases will come out?
Yeah, so I think the first one with the agency head, there was a case just like it last term involving the CFPB. So I think it's going to be pretty easy for the court to say, okay, the head of the FHFA also has to be removable by the president at will. But the real issue there is, so what is the court going to do? Is it going to just sever that provision from the statute, which amounts basically to judicial, lawmaking? I mean, revising a statute. But that has implications. This is called the severability doctrine. That has implications for cases like, the Affordable Care Act case that's at the court this term and a number of others. And to date, only 2 of the justices, Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch, are really on board as far as written opinions are really on board with not continuing with this severability doctrine. The Chief Justice seems to be a fan of it.
Kavanaugh, what is it exactly? Can you explain the idea of severability?
So it basically what the court does is it says, we're not going to strike down an entire law because of one little provision that is problematic from a constitutional perspective. So we're just going to say that that provision is inoperable and we're going to leave the rest of the law in place. But it requires a bit of psychoanalyzing of what Congress would have wanted when it passed the statute at that time, and whether they would have wanted, with the example of the housing agency head, would Congress have wanted an agency head who was directly accountable to the president or not. And we really can't psychoanalyze what Congress wanted, you know, looking back, you know, that law was passed more than a decade ago. And I don't think that's a proper assertion of the judicial power. And that's what Justices Thomas and Gorsuch have said. They've said, this is basically an advisory opinion, and it doesn't give any relief to the party that's suing here, because, you know, they aren't asking for us to sever this provision, and that doesn't give them any relief.
Right. So just from a non-lawyer perspective, completely, it sounds though that, like, if you didn't have the ability to sever things, then a 300-page bill that Congress spent years on could be struck down in its entirety for something on page 52C that, like, ran afoul of a specific provision. So is there some utility to it, or are you totally against it?
No, I definitely can see that. It's just, I think another case, the Obamacare case, the Affordable Care Act case, is another great example where severability is at issue, because they're looking at what the court, what Congress did with the original Affordable Care Act, and then what Congress did with the tax reform in 2017, where it said we're zeroing out the penalty associated with the individual mandate. And so if the court says we're just going to sever the individual mandate, is that going to fix the problem? I'm not sure.
Right. I guess part of it's because they're hesitant to not sever the stuff because they know Congress won't get its shit together and actually do things or pass legislation.
See, but I don't think that that's necessarily a reason for the court not to follow their judicial...
Oh, I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying Congress doesn't like to legislate these days. So
exactly. But you know what? I think the court needs to make them do it, you know?
Right. You're right. If they did strike down Obamacare in full, that would force, because of the unconstitutional provision, that would force Congress to actually do its job and make healthcare policy. Otherwise, they'll drag their heels and not pass anything.
That's right.
So I guess if you put this issue, all these issues of separation of powers, of severability, of constitutional liberties, the Bill of Rights, if you put it in a bigger picture context of how people should think about the Supreme Court in terms of being an institution that safeguards American liberties, what do you think that overall message and role is and should be?
Well, part of the judicial power is to basically police the limits of the separation of powers. So, you know, as you said earlier, you know, there's that great line from the Federalist that ambition will be made to counteract ambition. And as we've seen, unfortunately, Congress isn't jealously guarding its own sphere. And so I think it's important for the court to be to be vigilant in policing the lines between the constitutionally assigned spheres for each branch of government.
And is that necessarily a political or partisan thing, in the sense that even if you're a Democrat or a progressive, shouldn't you still want that?
I think that's right. But I think it comes down to the way people on the left and the right view courts in different ways. I think too often people on the left, and sometimes people on the right are guilty of this as well, they see the court as a way to get policies enacted that they can't get through state houses or in Congress or through a favorable administration. And so they go to the court and try to constitutionalize what they like and forbid what they don't like through the sort of blunt instrument of the Supreme Court. But, you know, putting aside whether, you know, which branch has the right power to make these policies, it's better for Congress because they can really weigh what different constituencies want, and they can tailor legislation in ways that a judicial opinion just can't.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question too, because people like to short circuit the system, like you're saying, when they like the outcome. Then they won't like it though when that same process is used a year from then to institute the other side's agenda. So to what extent do you see, and this is maybe a bigger picture question, but I think of things like the ideas of packing the Supreme Court, or that the idea that Brett Kavanaugh is an illegitimate justice, or these, it's, do you think the Supreme Court's, the future of it as an, as a, its integrity as an institution is in jeopardy?
So I don't. I mean, I think that people, you know, that is obviously something that a lot of time and energy is going into right now, is that we've got to, you know, add seats to the Supreme Court, or we've got to, you know, impeach justices that we don't like or we think are illegitimate or whatever it is. But I don't think we have a legitimacy crisis at the Supreme Court. If you look at the court, when it issues a ruling, people follow it. And that's the test of legitimacy. People follow what the Supreme Court says. And I think if we had, you know, whole scale, you know, uprisings of people refusing to follow what the court says, then maybe we could talk about there being a crisis of legitimacy. But I don't think that's where we're at right now.
But if they did pack the Supreme Court, do you think that would cause a crisis of legitimacy?
So the number of justices isn't set by the Constitution, which I think maybe a lot of people aren't aware that the number has fluctuated throughout history. And we've had 9 since the late 1800s. And that number seems to work pretty well. So my concern is that if one side, whichever side it is, decides to add, we're going to add 3 more seats, we're going to add 5 more seats, whatever it is, that's just going to continue. It's going to be tit for tat when the Senate and the presidency flip from one party to the next. And are we going to end up with a Supreme Court that has, you know, as many justices as we have members of Congress? You know, what's the line and where do we end? It seems like 9 has worked for a long time. And when the court, when Congress previously added seats, for the most part, it was because they were adding a new circuit court. You know, as the country was expanding throughout the 1800s, you know, they would add new seats to the Supreme Court to correspond with new parts of new territories that were becoming states.
Right. It's not the actual notion of expanding the number of seats that's inherently problematic. It's the idea of doing it to just cram a partisan, particular side's judges on there that I think a lot of people are worried about. But maybe it would just shift gears slightly. Can you just tell listeners about the DIST podcast and what you guys hope to do with it in this upcoming season, and where and why they can and should check it out?
Yeah, so we're on any platform where you listen to podcasts, and our second season drops April 7th. So DIST is a podcast exploring Supreme Court dissenting opinions throughout history. We want to share stories, untold stories, about some justices that people may have never heard of. It's a mix of history, constitutional law, and politics. So there's a little bit of something for everyone. And we're celebrating, you know, the court through the eyes of the losers throughout history. And some of the cases that we're going to be looking at, the dissents we'll be looking at coming up, are cases involving mandatory vaccinations, which I think is a pretty topical issue, affirmative action in college admissions, and unreasonable searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment.
All of those certainly sound pretty topical and relevant to me. So listeners should go check it out. There will be a link in the description of this episode. But now, Elizabeth, we wrap out every show, I know I told you this, with the hot food take from our guests, their controversial food opinions. So lay it on us.
Okay, my controversial, that's a mouthful, controversial food opinion, which is blasphemous because I live in the state of Maryland, is that I will not eat shellfish.
Yeah, so listeners will not like this, but I don't eat any seafood. I don't eat anything that comes out of the ocean except maybe seaweed. I would do. I like seaweed salad, but any fish or shellfish, nope, no, no, no.
Not for me.
Yeah, and I'm from Rhode Island. So that's where I was born and grew up, Rhode Island, and in New England generally, seafood's huge, you know, lobster, clam chowder, all the stuff. I've always thought it was all disgusting.
Maryland crab cakes, you know, I can't enjoy that.
Oh, well, they can hate, but that's the point of the food take. So Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks for having me.